Hi, this is Paul Siegel. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show.
Welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Dan. Paul could not be with us this week, so instead we're going to have a somewhat different experience. We're going to be chatting about classic D&D art with Brooklyn-based fine artist Isabel Garbani.
Hello, everybody.
Isabel, maybe give us a little bit about your practice and your artist experience.
Sure. So I'm actually a sculptor by training. And I do a lot of installations, but I am wearing my Captain Marvel t-shirt. I can't really find a way to show it to you.
You're going to come towards me.
Yeah, here we go. Look at this. So right. I'm perfectly qualified to talk about art because I have an MFA and a Captain Marvel shirt. So
that's pretty good. So I'll just pitch in a couple of things. And you've also done public installations here in New York City and around the world.
Correct.
Wisconsin and Taiwan and
Tunisia
and probably more places than I can remember.
Slovakia.
Right. Wow. Really?
Yeah.
Holy moly.
Yeah, I know.
Anyway, one of our viewers, I believe it was John Miller a couple weeks ago,
mm-hmm.
Came up with the idea of, after our Tolkien exhibit discussion, came up with the idea of discussing your observations in particular with classic D&D art. And we started investigating this this week and mm-hmm. really became totally overwhelmed. Became totally overwhelmed with the breadth and the depth and the number of artists and the number of pieces and the number of experiences with D&D art. So what we've decided to do is to try to narrow it down to just really the earliest classic art, probably like in the first 6 years, actually.
Right. I mean, our original plan was to look at the evolution of the art from, you know, year zero to now.
Right.
And it became very clear that it would be a 10-hour
podcast. Yeah, way too much. So we're going to look at, so the plan here is we're going to look at the transition from 0th edition mm-hmm. to 1st edition. Basically the first 6 years from 1974 up to 1980. This already might be an overwhelming, we're already worried that this is going to go possibly double length episode. So buckle up kids and get ready for that. The other thing is, as we've been preparing for this, is that we have just completely radical differences in experiences with D&D art.
Right.
So for me, I've been seeing these pieces for years, right? so since the inception, I have been, you know, I've been staring at these since I was 9, 10 years old.
Right.
And they're part of my upbringing, and they've been things that I've seen hundreds or possibly thousands of times. Whereas for you, most of these pieces you've basically just seen in the last week or maybe just yesterday.
Basically.
And so we have completely different experiences, and you're pointing out things that I have never noticed in 40 years. And the first things that pop out at you are things that I've never noticed.
Right.
And we disagree about a lot of it.
We do. We almost got divorced over
this. Who knew? Well, there was a little spoiler. in the episode for those of you who... Anyway, yep, so here's the show, and all kinds of unexpected things are going to be happening. So let's look at the first piece. So I've got these things. So we have 18 pieces. We picked out 6 artists, and we have 3 pieces each today. And I've got them in temporal order. So the very first thing, you know, one of the things why art in D&D is on people's minds is that Wizards of the Coast last year released a product called Art and Arcana about the overall history of art in D&D. We do not have that here, but people seem to really like it, and it's been getting a lot of buzz.
Yeah.
So I will start with one single piece from Art and Arcana, actually, where they do a very nice... look at the rather oddball fact that in original D&D, and we're looking at pieces from 1974, an artist named Greg Bell did a number of black and white pen and ink illustrations that were directly based out of Marvel Comics. And oddly enough, not multiple Marvel Comics, but one specific Marvel comic, one specific issue of Strange Tales number 167 from, I believe, April 1968. And it had one story about Doctor Strange with like some medieval stuff, and it had a story with Nick Fury. And so as you can see here, there's four pieces. The second piece was actually the cover.
Right.
So the second piece there, that knight on a horse from the Doctor Strange story, was actually the cover of the earliest D&D box and book set.
Right. When you actually pointed out that all the artwork were copied from the one comic strip,
yeah.
You know, I immediately thought, well, they were probably not even paying the guy enough money for him to buy multiple books. You know, so he only had to draw from this
yeah.
one book. But, you know, what's interesting...
And I will point out, they were yeah. a nickel at the time. Right?
And they were only a nickel
so,
at the time.
So apparently, poor Greg couldn't afford more than a single 5 cent
That's right.
issue.
But, you know, what's interesting to me about this, you know, is that, you know, and I talked to you a lot about it this week, is that it feels to me that even though, you know, they were on, you know, obvious copies of somebody else's artwork, it does establish kind of a style of what things are going to be later on.
Okay.
You know, in terms of... you know, what people are going to expect in terms of illustrations mm-hmm. and style, you know, and I feel like a lot of the stuff that we're going to see is very much steeped into the tradition of comics and illustration for comics. So
That's an interesting
yeah.
observation. Is that a good thing or a bad thing for you?
Well, this is where we almost got divorced.
You only get to use that one more time.
Oh, okay.
In
all
the
right.
episode.
Yeah, okay, all right. I mean, it can be, you know, the work that we're going to see today is actually very good, you know, and there's
right.
a lot of pieces that I really adore that I
right.
think are really fantastic. But to me, you know, I think I want to see exploration of more genre and different types and different history of art. You know, so, you know, I would love to see people using styles that are non-Western, for example, and kind of like go more into the exploration of, you know, non-Western art, especially because we're dealing with a fantastical world. So, you know, everything is up for grabs. You know, we don't have to limit ourselves. So I feel like, you know, and obviously, you know, the magazines and the books are curated by someone. Someone is picking the artwork. So, you know, that person's taste, you know, is going to kind of dictate what the art is going to be in general. So I wish there was like a little bit more variety in some sense. You know, so it's not a diss on what's there, but it's just like, you know, I'd like to see more. I'd like to see more. Yeah.
And when you say, I think that's an interesting observation because it sounds almost identical to the start. You haven't read it, but it sounds almost identical to the start of Scott McCloud's Understanding Comics book.
Right.
Is that's the exact same premise that he starts with, as far as there's a whole ocean of possibilities that we haven't explored, and we should start exploring those.
Right.
I should point out that historically, when the people at TSR realized that Greg Bell had basically copied those pieces, the later publications removed it for at least from the cover.
Right.
So they replaced that knight on a horse with a wizard, I think, throwing a spell at some orcs, and they removed that. And there's kind of some hard feelings by some of the people that worked at TSR.
Mm-hmm.
Those first two pieces that we just looked at were in the Marvel Comics, were originally by an artist named Jim Steranko. So to a certain extent, it was Marvel Comics Jim Steranko that sort of had the first theme, I guess.
Right.
Dripping into D&D.
Right, right.
So you picked out. Hey, Scott. Glad you're watching. So you picked out two other pieces. So you flipped through a zeroth edition yesterday, and you picked out two other pieces. And I was a little surprised by what you picked because you really wanted to talk about this piece.
Yes.
So this is the Amazon from Volume 1. So this is 1974. It's a little unclear, some of these pieces, who they're by. I think
right.
I'm going to guess that's by Greg Bell again.
Right.
Why did you want to talk about that?
Well, I don't know if you... And there was another one that I picked. I don't know if you can put them side by side.
I can't, but I can.
Oh, you can. Okay. Well, why don't you show that to folks, okay. And then we can just flip back and forth.
Okay. So here's the other piece that's definitely by Greg Bell. Now this is in the first supplement, the Greyhawk right. supplement in 1975, about 8 months later. He
right.
probably drew this in 1974.
Right. Right.
And one of the interesting things here, and again, this is something that Isabel just pointed out 30 minutes before the show started that I didn't realize. The picture on the left is, I guess, a slightly earlier printing that I have a paper copy of, and obviously the woman. Sort of a Conan type scene here. You got a giant snake, you got a Conan, you have a woman in jeopardy here. And in the original on the left, she's topless. And in, I guess, the later edition that I have a PDF copy of course, she's been clothed.
Right. So maybe go back to the Amazon.
Right.
I mean, you know, the two pieces, you know, I kind of burst out laughing when I saw them because this looks, I'm going to try to be gentle about how I describe this. You know, but it really looks to me like it's a 13-year-old, you know, who really likes boobies, and he just wants to draw a lot of boobies, but he hasn't really seen any of them. And so he's practicing, and, you know, and they're like, you know, especially the second one, you know, the boobs
right.
are like, they're in the wrong place, they're in the wrong shape, you know, and it's kind of like very gratuitous and juvenile, and it just made me laugh so hard. But the problem that I have, you know, because I have no problem with nudity, in
right.
comics or in art in general,
right.
you know, or on the beach. Do whatever you want. You know, love your body. But the Amazon in particular, you know, she does not look like an Amazon to me. You know, like an Amazon
okay.
to me, you know, is like this beautiful, fearless, powerful woman, you know, and she looks super sexy and she's going to kick your ass. And this woman does not look like she's going to kick your ass. At all. She looks like she's going to do something else. But it's not a kick your ass. And so, you know, it feels like really gratuitous nudity and really kind of silly. You know, she looks like a come hither Las Vegas stripper, you know, circa 1973.
Well, you know, some people might call that praiseworthy.
Hey, you know, whatever you're into, that's fine. But she doesn't look like an Amazon. So, you know, it's like, it's very amateurish and, you know, and a little bit juvenile and a little bit sexist. And I'm really glad that they hired professional artists. So
okay.
I guess that was,
okay.
that my take was like, I'm really glad that they hired professional artists
okay.
after that. Because that is just really a little bit too cheesy. And I would like to point out too, you know, I keep interrupting you, but I'd like to point out that, and maybe, you know, it's like my pre-internet brain is not really there anymore. But you know, when you did your Book of War artwork, you went
Available from OED currently
from
on OED.com, yeah.
Right. You actually went and got artwork in the public domain.
Yeah.
So, you
yeah.
know, you couldn't afford artists and, you know, you had specific things that you wanted. And I understand, you know, this is like in the 70s, there's no internet, you know, you have to go to a library, but you really can you could have found something in the public domain too, you know, at that time. And so I think I'd rather see no art than something that's so super
okay.
cheesy like
okay.
that. So
as we transition from original D&D, I should point out, like, I did not have that when I was a kid. So I got into D&D. I got into D&D like right after, like with the Holmes Basic set. So right after that was no longer available in hobby shops, I guess. So I didn't actually have the original 0th edition stuff in my hands until about 10 years ago. So those aren't pieces that I grew up with. I don't mind the Amazon. I actually don't mind. I don't mind the Amazon.
Yeah,
I don't look at that and go, I'm offended.
I'm not offended. I just
I don't,
think it's funny.
I don't mind it. And you know, if space opera or, you know, maybe Jane Fonda-ish type thing.
Sure.
I wonder if that piece had a source.
Maybe that's possible.
Because it
I don't
seems
know.
your points about, like, she looks like something very specific.
Yeah.
Seems like. That might have been. I wonder where that came from. Anyway.
Well, if anybody knows out there, let us know.
Anyway, okay. So duly noted. So to you, that looks ridiculous, and to me, I'm like, I don't mind.
Yeah.
I don't mind that.
Okay,
so the rest of the show is we're now going to transition to more professional art
right.
in advanced D&D. So that supplement there that we just looked at was 1975, and then they had a couple other supplements to right. original D&D. And then after another 2 years, they had a larger project, and they're going to start putting all that material together in hardbound books.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to call it Advanced D&D.
Mm-hmm.
And so in 1977, you start seeing the Monster Manual comes out.
Right.
Which is compatible with both original D&D and this new, what we call now, first edition. So the first thing that... I should point out, we're going to look at all interior art. Like, among the limitations we set ourselves is we're actually not going to look at the cover art. So we're going to be looking at all interior black and white illustrations, mostly the larger ones. So this, 1977, this is a David Sutherland piece
mm-hmm.
From the Monster Manual of adventurers fighting a apparently large band of kobolds.
Mm-hmm.
So... You like this, right?
I do like this, okay. and I think that's the first one where I pointed out to you why I liked it.
Right.
That and there was something that you never really thought about. So what I like about it, and I think that's what you dislike about it, I like the fact that you have, and I don't know how well you can see that on your screen, but the background is like this very abstract background that has like very, very strong horizontal and vertical lines. Right, and so you don't really know what's going on up there, and on top of that, you have this battle scene where you have like really, really strong diagonal lines. So if you look at the guy that has the shield with like the, I don't know, is that an ant or something?
Yeah.
So his sword is pointing to the wizard's hat, so that it's making this like really nice diagonal line going across, and then the kobold's spear is pointing to the guy's armor to the guy behind him's shoulder, and the other guy's I think I can't really see, is that a hat?
Yeah.
So you know, again, you have like a, if you start looking, you start seeing a lot of like really strong horizontal lines going, you know, bottom to top and then left to right, you know. And so to me, you have like this very neutral abstract background. You don't really know what's going on. Is that something that's like threatening, or something weird is happening? And on top of that, you have the chaos of the battle with like this really violent diagonals going across. And I thought, you know, if you look at it, like, you know, squint your eyes a little bit, you can see all of that, and you really get like the feeling of like fear and chaos that could happen in a battle. So I really love that compositionally. I think that's really, really successful.
It's an interesting, and again, I've been looking at this for decades, and so your point is basically that, like, the first thing that jumps out at you is that every single one of the kobolds' spears and swords are all aligned in this same southwest and northeast direction,
mm-hmm.
along with the lead fighter's sword. And it's something that never, I don't think, ever occurred to me.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it's, you know, it's nice, but I honestly would always look at this and say it looks a little primitive.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that there's this giant expanse of black background that's just this hash mark,
mm-hmm.
it always struck me as a little primitive-ish, and maybe the lead two kobolds in the foreground seem a little flat to me. The adventurers seem round, and they seem like they take up space, and like they exist in a world that I know. And the kobolds are a little flat, and then but then the primitiveness of it actually makes it feel dangerous to me. Like
right.
like the adventurers are stepping into an alien, threatening, Lovecraftian world. Like if one of those people take another 5 foot step away, they're going to fall into a completely different dimension.
And
so,
I know what I pointed out to
yeah.
you yesterday. So you were bothered by the fact that the two kobolds in the foreground are kind of flat, and they are kind of flat,
yeah.
I think, on purpose. I mean, this artist did not do that by accident.
Yeah.
And what I pointed out to you is that the texture that they have on their scale and armor and whatnot
right.
is actually really close to the background cross hatching.
Okay.
So it feels like they're actually, maybe they're like spontaneously coming out of this weird background that you don't really quite understand, you know, and that makes it feel more threatening, because if that's the case, then everything around this battle can potentially have, you know, those monsters pop out. So I thought that was you know, I love this piece. I think, you know, compositionally and, you know, in terms of the theme and what you're trying to convey about battle, I think was like really, really successful. So.
It's an interesting thing because I look at it and it looks a little primitive to me, and yet that totally works.
It works.
It makes me scared.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, it makes me scared for me and everybody involved.
Right, right.
So other Monster Manual things that you thought were interesting to look at would be this piece here in the next to the section on giant spiders.
Mm-hmm.
And this is by Dave Trampier.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you what my impression, my old school impression is, and I'll transition to your, like, hey, I just discovered this 2 days ago.
Right.
So this has always felt super scary to me. That spider is freaking huge. You know, it clearly tells a story of very D&D adventures. You know, so this is clearly a piece made by somebody that has played D&D, knows that we've got a party, they're burdened down, they're carrying too much stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously the lead people have found a clue but haven't found the actual monster. And then, if you look carefully, there's this finger pointing in the background that some party member in the back has seen the actual monster, is attempting to warn everybody about it, but because of that, has distracted them. And now that elf or whoever it is now looking in the worst possible direction. The warning might actually cause them to be murdered 1 second from now. So it's this very kind of nightmare Murphy's Law. Like, I'm trying to help, and now it's even worse than before I tried to help.
Right.
What was you saw this on two separate days, and actually the first day you were like, eh, and then the second day you were like, oh, I guess that's better than I thought.
Right, yeah, upon possible, like, I really like it, and I think when Trampier does really high contrast illustration, I think they're so successful and so scary, you know, and you have like a little bit of texture in the back and you don't really know what that is, you know, it's the same behind the spider web, there's something there, and you know, is this like a decomposing corpse or treasure, or we don't know what it is. So
yep,
you have
nice.
Like this really, you know, incredible sense of depth because there's like something that's, you know, popping out, you know, coming at you in the background, you know, and I think it's just very successful. You know, it's just a, you know, a very successful composition and, you know, a handling of the ink. What was interesting is that you and I had like a completely different interpretation of that finger pointing at the monster. So I see that elf in the back and I see the finger pointing at the monster, and I'm like, well, that guy is like ordering that elf to go fight, and he's like, oh, I don't think so. Have you seen the look of this? I'm not going over there. So I, you know, like, I feel like it's somewhat like forcing that poor elf to go fight, and he's like,
that's,
no, please don't make me fight.
That is it's really interesting that I thought that this was a really obvious thing that was happening, and like, I don't know, now that you say that, yeah, maybe, like, I could imagine one of my players like throwing a charm spell on somebody, right? Like,
exactly.
Oh, you go deal with that while I run away.
You go kill that spider. I'm going to stay behind that rock over
that
there.
That is completely on the board for standard D&D. And,
yeah.
And your point about like the stuff behind the web, I don't think I've ever felt like I've ever thought about that, but you're right.
It's
like,
what is it?
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
You know, are you gonna like find the bodies of your friends, or are you gonna find 1,000 gold pieces?
That is a really good point about whether that's like some kind of like head with a helmet, like dead person with a helmet on, or
it
something.
It could be anything. So I think that's it's kind of funny that we have different interpretations of it.
That is
weird. Yeah.
So now we're moving on to, I should come back to us is what I should do. Great. Okay, so that's the Monster Manual. We're going to, when Advanced D&D, or what we now call First Edition, was released, they released one book per year. Nowadays, when you come out with a new edition, you release all three books all at once, hopefully.
Mm.
But they were, you know, getting into this, and they were learning the process, and they just released one book per year. So the next year, 1978, you had the Player's Handbook, which is probably the most commonly used book, at least by players. Possibly, I think, the highest sales of any role-playing product ever. They were selling the first edition Player's Handbook for at least 10 years, from 78 up to around 1990, I think.
Mm.
And they supposedly, at the end, they had like a warehouse full of hundreds of thousands of these things that they had to ditch at the end, but even besides what they were selling. So anyway... Here is the first piece that you picked out. So this is, that's Sutherland, right?
Yes, that's Sutherland, yeah.
Yeah. So this is Sutherland's famous A Paladin in Hell piece from the Player's Handbook, the page right after you get the Paladin class. And lots of people love it. This was so popular that Monty Cook, 10 years later, wrote an adventure called A Paladin in Hell, basically, just to explain how this happened, basically. So a whole adventure based just on this.
Mm-hmm.
So I always liked this. It wasn't my... I think I was a lot older before I really paid attention to, like, the lighting.
Mm-hmm.
That's very nice. These are all monsters that you can specifically identify in the demon section of the monster manual. So as a gamer, I get a little tweak of like, oh, I know what that is, and I have enough knowledge to identify this, and this. And obviously he's on this cliff that apparently he might be dropping to his doom in just a second.
Right.
The bottom left has a creature that's actually been totally exterminated by him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this big bug thing in the middle might be like retreating with an injury or something like that. Why did you pick this out?
Well, same thing. I think, you know, the composition is like very, very strong. You know, and again, you have like this really nice line, you know, that kind of like makes your eyes go from the bottom left of the page all the way to the fighter,
know,
and so you follow this action, and because it's like the action goes off the page, you know, you really get a sense that this like this endless stream of monsters and devils and whatnot that are going to come out, and you know, this guy is just going to have to fight forever. So, you know, I think it's very successful that way. It's just, you know, the way that your eyes is being led from the bottom of the pit all the way to him really gives you this terrorizing feeling that this is just like, there's going to be this endless battle and he will probably die in exhaustion before he can finish off everything. So, I like the way, you know, he's handling the ink and the textures are really quite wonderful, you know, and you have like really nice juxtaposition of like those really dark, dark figures and then this really delicate texture with the ink, you know, all the delicate little line work that he has, you know, and again, you know, that kind of like really leads you to him. So I really like that. I really like that a lot.
I totally agree. The thing that I just realized that you're saying is that all the monsters are all different, right?
Mm.
They're all unique, separate types of monsters. There's no two monsters of the same species in that picture.
Got it.
I think. And so not only does it suggest that there's like an endless number of monsters, but there's also an endless variety of monsters.
Right.
Like this place that he's in is so horrible that it can belch up an infinite number of monsters and they're not even the same type ever.
Right.
Which is pretty horrifying to think about.
And then one more thing I want to point out, you know, since, you know, I started out by saying, you know, there's like a language of comics that, you know, is very much borrowed. And you can see that in the way that the light is being rendered, you know, like that's a very comic style, you know, lighting area here, you know, with
so the aura around the
aura
paladin.
Around the paladin,
So Mr. Anderson here is pointing out that the demons should all look different. They're creatures of chaos. I totally agree. Classic D&D does have these tables for roll up a random demon and it will never be the same. Now these demons in this picture are all specific types from the monster manual, but in general I agree with that and I like the... So I'm also thinking about game mechanics that make demons of chaos all different, which I kind of like.
Yeah.
You're right. I think there might be maybe just two that are the same. I like that. I feel like the line work, I mean, obviously the lighting around the paladin is different than the monsters.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that the light, the line work on the paladin is different.
Yes.
And clearly, obviously, the inking is very different, which I like. The one to the left of the cliff, you have these kind of wispy things that maybe they're fumes from the underworld.
Right.
Maybe they're like Lovecraftian
tentacle
monsters
or something like that.
I don't know, which is fantastic.
Right.
Fantastic ambiguity.
Right.
The one thing I got to say that has always bothered me with this picture is that that does give me a little trouble, and I apologize to everybody for this. I think he's holding the shield upside down.
Oh, yeah.
So I look at
that.
It's right in the lit up area, and it always... So having looked at this stuff a little bit more closely this week, actually, I think that how you'd hold a shield of that shape is the arm ought to be like horizontally across it, not up and down the long way, right? And that the flat top would be held up and the pointy part would be held down partly to guard your shins.
You know,
so
I'm gonna put
always...
that. It says the fog of war, my friend. The fog of war. You know,
that's
and he
always...
just grabbed his shield however he could.
Yeah, the straps and, wouldn't, but the straps wouldn't even be in that direction in the first
license.
Place. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, all right. So there's me digging on that. So anyway, I look at that, and that's one little. That is one little thing that like gives me a little distracts me a little bit.
Mm.
All right. What is that? Was okay. So a couple pages later in. Player's Handbook. I'm going to get that there. There we go. Okay.
Yeah.
So, interesting. So, this is another piece by David Sutherland, and it's stuck in the middle of the spell roster, so it's kind of cropped so that one of the longer spell lists can run into it. Wouldn't be one of the ones I would have picked out as super iconic, but you picked this out, and you were like, wow. So I look at this. It's obviously in theme with the spell list. It's a wizard reading his spell book with all kinds of, you know, familiars, I guess, around. Now that I look at it, I like the depth that the window gives you of, you know, looking outside while he's in his dark chamber.
Mm-hmm.
So I've always liked this. I got to admit, as a rules guy, I'm always looking at that page hunting for a particular spell in that roster. So my eye tends to skip over a little bit. Why did you pick that out?
So that was the first piece, I think, that I picked from Sutherland.
Yeah, the very first piece, yeah.
Because we were comparing Sutherland Tramp here at some point when we were discussing what we were going to do in the kitchen. And I wanted to point out, like, again, you know, the really, really strong overall compositional lines that he has and how he leaves you to look at the next thing. And how much depth he has, even though, you know, the background is like completely dark.
Yeah.
You have this little thing in the back that's like starting to peek out. So you get the sense that this in the back is going on forever.
Yeah.
And if you look at the tail of the dragon that's being wrapped around that pole there, you know, so you look at that tail, and if you, again, take that diagonal, that leads you to the line at the bottom of the ghost. The ghost takes your eye up. And then around and towards, you know, towards the the creature
the
tusk, in the shadow,
right.
And then back to the creature that's on the shoulder of the wizard.
Right.
And so everything is kind of like really nicely framing the wizard and leading your eye, you know, like from one end of the page to the other, to the thing that's really important, which is the wizard looking at the spell book.
Yeah.
So I thought that, you know, that was a really successful piece.
Yeah.
Just in the way he was using his composition and leading from one thing to the other, which is, you know, an exercise that I make my students do too, you know, to try find, you know, compositionally, like how are you going to lead the eyes of the viewer, you know, around your artwork to what you really want them to see, to what's really important. So I think that was like, to me, it's like very, very successful that way. So, yeah.
Your talk about compositions has been educational for me. Like, I tend to see, I tend to see individual elements a little bit more. Now that I'm looking at it more closely, the what we'd call a pseudo-dragon on the post there kind of echoes, like, the caduceus symbol of Apollo or medical centers.
I think it has
the same number of twists on it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then that the familiar on his shoulder, which we call a quasit, like, I look at that and I'm like, you know, that's like everything here is dangerous. Everything here is dangerous.
Right.
You could fall out the window. You could get bitten by the dragon. You could get possessed by the ghost. I guess you can consume by the boar thing. And then that quasit is like his claws are so sharp that I can almost feel the guy getting, you know, stabbed. Like, why is he not bleeding from the skull right now? I mean, sometimes, right. So and then, you know, one of the great things I like about this is that it echoes what I'm doing. When I'm on this page, I'm inspecting closely this list of spells, looking for a particular thing that I need. and I've got a bald guy with a big book right. echoing exactly what I'm doing at that moment, and quite likely I'm being stabbed by our cat, who might be, like, hanging on my shoulder at this exact moment. So, like, I have a bunch of, you know, I'm usually healing up. I'm usually healing up from a number of spots from our cat, who's usually on top of me while I'm going through that book.
That's funny. But, you know, like, doing magic is dangerous business, right?
Yeah.
You know, you could screw it up and
right.
really, you know, do some damage to yourself.
No
so
kidding.
I think, you know, that's actually
yeah.
a really successful piece because
yeah.
of that, you
yeah.
know? So
yeah, you're right.
Anyway, so I really like that piece. That was the first piece by Sutherland that I saw.
Yeah.
And I was just like, oh, he's my favorite artist. But then I had another favorite artist after that.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. Okay.
I'll tell you later.
So this might be the one or two last pieces in the Player's Handbook. So this is from Dave Trampier, and it's near the end of the book. In the section on things like, I think, recovery and kind of mundane things, like I think the encumbrance chart is on this table, movement chart, recovering, stuff like that. So here we have men, like I've always read them as sailors or dock workers in kind of a crappy bar down by the docks, and the wood has a lot of grain to it, and, you know, the guy in the bottom right looks happy, but really nobody else does. So again, I feel like this is one of these things where you probably wouldn't see this in newer, more recent D&D. This picture isn't really heroic. It's a little downcast. To me, it's like concrete. It's mundane. It says, here's a world of, you know, of labor and effort that maybe your characters aren't paying attention to right now. And I've always liked this piece a lot.
Yeah, I think this is the third time I can use the divorce thing.
Yeah, this
yeah.
would be a
so this is the piece we almost got divorced over. Because I actually, that is my least favorite. I mean, there are things about
yeah,
it that I can appreciate.
Yeah.
You know, I think, like, you know, it gives me, like, a really... like, a strong sense of, like, you know, maybe this is, like, an old-timey, you know... printing plates,
yeah, right.
You know, like the lines are very strong, especially on the faces, you know,
right.
And you have like this really like very strong sense of texture on everything.
Right.
But there are so many things that bother me. You know, again, I always go back to the composition.
Yeah.
There's so many things that bother me with that I started pointing out to Dan, and maybe
Tell me what bothers you, and then we'll have the knockdown
yeah.
drag out argument.
Yeah, we'll have the knockdown. So one of the things that you can do as in art to create a sense of space is have things overlap. Right. So, you know, like one thing is obviously in front of the other, and you know, so that way you can. You know, especially when you have, you know, line illustration where you maybe don't have a lot of shadowing, you know, you can create a sense that, you know, there are things that are in front of each other, and that's
right.
a really great, you know, tool in your art arsenal to have. And here, there's like three or four different pieces where the overlap is, you know, drives me just to the brink of insanity. So one of them is like, so the figure on the left in the foreground,
right.
If you look at the top of his head, and it might not be so clear on your screen, but if you
yeah,
look at the...
they'll be seeing it larger.
Yeah,
larger
so
scale.
If you look at the person behind him who's at the bar, he's got like a little hood or collar or whatever, and that is just really close to the head, and it's like, so now I'm like... I don't get a sense of, like, it's messing with my perception of what's in front and what's not, right? So it's either, you know, you have to put that line way further up from the head or just have the head completely cover it. And then if you have the head completely cover it, then I have a sense of, you know, you create a better sense of depth. Furthermore, I'm not done yet.
You okay?
But the one thing that really drives me nuts is
right.
that bottle
yeah.
going up to that wall in the back of the
yeah.
bar.
Yeah.
Again, you know, if he had overlapped it differently, that would
right.
be fine. But the thing is, like, the top of the bottle is, like, just, like, a tiny little bit off.
Right.
So, you know, the line either should be, like, you know, the line of the bottle and the line of the wall should be, like, exactly the same or should have, like, more obvious... space, you know, between the two. And then, you know, the hand of the sailor behind that drinking that mug is also problematic, you know, like, so all that area to me is like is an overlap disaster.
I will say that these things have never bothered me. These things have never bothered me looking at this picture for four decades.
Right.
Now, the line, the collar above on the left above the bald guy's head, that really doesn't bother me. Now that you've pointed out the bottle and the side of the bar, now that's starting to drag my attention there.
Right.
But that never naturally happened for 40 years. So
the problem is when I see this illustration, all I see is that bottle and the wall, and I'm like, oh my God, it's driving me crazy.
Right.
So you know, you can send hate mail to Dan Collins at Paul Siegel.
Everybody enjoy Isabel's last appearance on Wandering DMs. So one that came out is you're not the biggest. So Trampier's not your favorite.
You know, why do you have to say that in public?
Well, I mean, that was a contentious point. Spoiler. Yeah. I mean, you looked at Sutherland, and you're like, oh, interesting composition.
That's
Trampier's
right.
actually not your favorite.
Right.
So to me. And I think which is sort of heresy, and to me
it is. I know, right? I understand,
and I'm like,
that.
There was a moment where I was like, I'm not sure we should do this show.
It's true.
But to me, you know, Trampier has solidity and depth and heft and weight and concreteness, and the world feels heavy, and the world feels Catonian, and it feels like there's a whole world that I could step into and deal with, and that it exists beyond me, and that it would take a great amount of effort to move those guys or move those chairs out of the way. So Trampier has a weight, a weightiness to him that beats any other D&D artist that I've seen, and I really love that about him.
Well, that's fine.
Yeah.
You're entitled to your opinion. Yeah. It's just an opinion.
But as far as, like, composition, if you had to, like, tap Sutherland or Trampier, who would you pick?
I would definitely pick Sutherland, yeah. Well, and actually, you know, he got displaced by another artist that I saw later on when I was flipping through the
books.
But
the composition thing, I think, is a thing that doesn't immediately hit my gut. Like, I don't think I get a feeling out of the compositional things that you're pointing out, whereas I immediately get a feeling from Trampier of weight and presence.
Right. And, I, you know, in all fairness to me, you know, like, I think that Trampier's work when he, like I said, when he has, like, those really high contrast illustrations, I think are fabulous.
Yeah.
You know, but I think the other stuff that I saw where, you know, there's a lot more detailed line work didn't grab me as much.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Now we're moving on to 1979, and after a great deal of labor, Gary Gygax has finally put together the largest tome to date in role-playing called The Dungeon Master's Guide, 1979, and you get some new artists coming in, and the next piece that we're going to look at is by Darlene Pecoul. And show that to the people. So you saw this in the DM's guide, and immediately we want to talk about this. So Darlene is still active, and she did a number of pieces for D&D. She also did probably the most famous map in role playing, which is the map to the World of Greyhawk, which is Gary Gygax's campaign world, and so she's famous forever for that. Still active. I briefly saw her at a convention in February, and she will have a booth selling current work that you can go and get signed pieces from Darlene today. So this is the piece from pretty early in the DM's guide of, I guess, a party of adventurers meeting maybe a dryad or something like that in the woods. And I've always really liked this, and it feels very medieval. The people feel... you know, realistic to medieval art to me, and they seem kind of frail. They're not superheroes. It feels like they're in a place where, like, if anything jumps out of that the woods behind them or the pond below them, they could very easily, you know, be broken. So it seems like they have narrow, you know, the spears they're holding are very narrow, and it seems like anything could come from any direction and be very dangerous to them. And I've always really liked this a lot, and it has a lot of depth to it. Why did this jump out at you?
Well, I think for the same reason that you like it. You know, I mean, I'm a sucker for anything medieval. I love medieval art. You know, I love medieval architecture. I love, you know, and, you know, obviously D&D is, you know, has a lot of, like, influence from, you know, you know, the King Arthur tales, yeah, and, you know, Knight of the Round Table and, you know, all of that stuff. So, you know, this really feels like it's part of that world,
yeah,
you know, and yeah, you know, feels very medieval. I like, you know, to point out, like, the way the horse is actually drawn, if you look at medieval illustrations,
yeah,
you know, the
yeah
way they... The faces of horses are usually
yeah
drawn is like this, and the feet of people, you know, it's like this very pointy, you know, delicate
right
foot.
Right.
You know, and the people are like, they're realistic, but there's like a little bit of a stiffness
yeah
in them. That's also something that you find a lot in medieval art.
Yeah.
You know, the visual language is different from Renaissance
yeah
art. So to me, that was like, you know, that's just a beautiful piece of art,
yeah,
because it just appeals to my, you know, medieval sensibility.
Yeah. I've
so
always liked this. And
yeah
as a general thing in not just the Darlene's, the earliest work, I mean, they have pretty realistic equipment and armor, right? They were clearly looking at actual real armor, which I kind of like. And I really like the characters... like looking not super heroic. And it's funny because I just wrote a blog post yesterday debating with myself about whether D&D characters should start off heroic or not.
Mm.
Right? But the majority of fantasy art nowadays assumes that you're elite, assumes that you're a superhero. And certainly the as published, the D&D game, you start off, you're very frail.
Right.
A single sword hit might go right through you and you'd be done.
Right.
And these pieces of art communicate that to me.
Right.
Communicate the expectation of the game is you're starting off as a normal person who's at great peril.
Right.
And I like... So that's the kind of art that early stuff communicated to me when I saw it. Is I immediately got the... You're clearly in a great deal of peril.
So, and the other thing that I want to point out... So, you know, we saw the very early Amazon and,
right,
you know, how she was portrayed.
Right.
And, you know, this is not an Amazon, obviously.
Right.
But, you know... She's a beautiful, and she's, you know, she's a sexy woman, you know, I'd take her out to dinner, you know, but she, you know, there's no, like, the way it's rendered is much more gentle and, you know, mature.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
So... You know, there's no, like, need to put, like, Gertuda's nudity or anything like that. Or, you know, she could have put, you know, something where, you know, her top was transparent. She chose not to do that.
Right.
You know, so
right.
So I also appreciate that, you know, the woman looks like an actual woman.
Right.
You know,
right.
So that was good.
Will that, do you think that'll continue to be the case in Darlene's future work?
I don't know.
Yeah.
We shall see.
Great.
Tune in.
Okay, so just a couple pages later, here's another piece by Darlene.
Right.
And the funny thing is, when you turn to this in the book, like, I have all kinds of stuff written in my book. So I have margin notes and I have post-it notes. And so I just happen to be using this space for two post-it notes. One page before it is the movement rules that I'm always crunching numbers on. Right below it are the infravision rules. And so we had to remove the post-it notes for you to see this piece, and you're like, "Well, this is intriguing." And I've always liked this. Obviously, the colors are wonderful. The mostly dark tones are wonderful. It's interesting as far as how it works with the rules on the two sides. So you have the movement rules immediately before it, and you have this ship going someplace along with a person on a horse going someplace. And then right below this picture, you have the infravision rules if you don't have light. And I'm thinking, okay, maybe if the clouds totally obscure the sun, maybe this kind of weird shaded thing is what I would see if I had infravision or something like that. So not only is it just a wonderful piece of art, but it also slots right into that part of the rule set right there in at least three or four different ways. It's really beautiful.
Yeah, I think that... I saw the post-it note and I was like, oh, wait, there's something underneath. And I'm
yeah
like, oh my God, he covered up like the best piece of art in the book.
Yeah.
Yeah, this has like just drama and, you know, and it looks, you know, a little bit different from the rest of the artwork that we've seen,
yeah,
you know.
And, yeah.
And again, she has like, you know, she's had like a little tinge of like, you know, medieval you know, influence in terms of, like, you know, how the horse is drawn and, you know, how everything is kind of treated. But it's just, you know, the high contrast, you know, makes it just, like, really beautiful and terrifying all at once.
Yeah.
It's, you know, so I'm not sure what else we can say except that it's just a beautiful piece of art.
Yeah, and it makes me, you know, this is one of these pieces that make you want to write an adventure to see all this, because now I'm curious about every single part of this.
Yeah.
I'm curious about who the person on the horse is. I'm curious about what the heck is that weapon thing that he's carrying.
Right.
I'm not entirely sure that that's a thing.
And who's coming on that ship?
And for me, you know, as a big ship, you know, fetishist, like that ship is just beautiful, and now I want it. Like, the very next thing I want to do is I want to turn to the Player's Handbook, see what the cost of a ship would be like that would be, and buy it for my character. Like, I immediately want, how can I get that ship?
So it's a great marketing image.
Yeah, it's a promotional piece
for
Gary's Galleys. And, you know, and it's lonely, right? It's dark, it's lonely. It's like, you know, the figure on the horse is clearly going someplace alone. And when you're on a ship in the middle of the ocean with, you know, water and waves around you, that's lonely too. And the mountains rising in the back are dangerous because it kind of implies there's some sort of cliffs dropping into the water someplace. And in the interest of time, we'll move on. So here's a piece, super, super famous.
Oh, I think you forgot a Darlene piece.
Did I?
Oh, is it later?
Sorry. We're good. So here's a piece close to the end of the Dungeon Master's Guide. Super, super famous, super, super popular. And so this is by Dave Trampier with his classic dense ink work. And it's titled A Miracle of the Chaotic. And so I've seen this, and I've seen this loved and beloved and spoofed and redrawn and all kinds of sort of times. And so obviously there's, I guess, this wizard character riding through the streets here on a horse, creating chaos. You have some adventurers running out of the Green Dragon Inn, which I think was an actual piece in Gary Gygax's games. And people adore this, and it has depth, and I'm sure that you agree that this is one of the best pieces in D&D.
Why do you hate me, Dan? So, I'm sorry, once again, this is not my favorite piece of art, and I was trying to figure out, actually, last night, why it didn't grab me. And I it just occurred to me, I think this morning, I think the street looks too clean.
Okay.
You know, I grew up in a town that still had a lot of medieval streets around. So, you know, like, I've walked around medieval streets and I know what they look like, and they're narrow and dark, and, you know, the buildings are, you know, not so rectilinear,
okay.
So I think there's something about it that kind of, like, you know, like, I don't get the sense that, you know, every morning somebody, you know, takes their chamber pot and, like, throws their feces down the street. I don't get the feeling of that, and I think that's what bothers me about it. It's just, like, it's just a little too clean.
So I'm gonna surprise you.
Oh,
here.
Yeah, and I know you told me that you found.
I'm gonna surprise you here with a piece you have not seen
before
this second.
I know,
and that I hadn't
seen.
This
is why I brought my whiskey with me.
So.
I mean, you know.
If this episode spawns fan commentary, I have no idea what it would be like. And I hadn't seen the following thing until in the last month. I actually got on Twitter in just the last month, and someone found an illustration. So apparently that street, I'll just bring it back up again, what we're looking at here. So that street was apparently based on an actual street in the real world, and here it is.
Right.
So that is a street called the Road of Knights, I guess, the Way of Knights.
Mm-hmm.
That's a street in Rhodes, Greece,
mm-hmm.
and it's part of their medieval old town,
mm-hmm.
which is a UN World Heritage Site now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that is clearly, I'll just jump back to the here's Trampier's piece, and you can see that it fits in pretty much perfectly well. with that exact street. And so I've, so if you put them side by side, the doors are exactly the same and the windows are exactly the same.
Sure. But I think my point
So I think I won the argument,
that
right?
I don't think you did
I think everybody watching knows that I won that argument. And that is a perfect representation of an actual medieval town.
Au contraire, mon frère. You know, I think in this, you know, it's probably restored. Right, obviously. Two, you know, right. I think you have like a lot of like crumbling stuff and
no.
moss blowing around, and you know, I don't think everything is like. I think his buildings are a little bit too perfect. Is
okay.
my point.
Okay.
You know, like here, if you see the stones, they're not perfect.
Right.
Right. I mean, you know, they didn't have you know laser cutters and didn't have
right.
like power tools. So you know, that's my problem with it. So I see what you're saying. You know, I get it, but I think I won that argument.
I don't think so. I think I won that argument. Now,
anyway, you can vote.
It,
text 555-5555 for yes.
Just write a comment. Just everybody write a comment that you agree with me and not Isabel would be great.
That's acceptable. But agree with me.
So it comes to mind that we ought to do an episode sometime on like. But French pronunciation in D&D.
Oh my god, I would get so many hate mail. So.
Okay, so another piece by Darlene, and this is almost the very last thing in the Dungeon Master's Guide. So this is a demon that we'd call a succubus in D&D, maybe in the real world or something like that, possibly at night. And so, as a kid in a rural place, when D&D was much more suspect, and I was 9 or 10 years old, this would be a page that I would scrupulously hide from my parents.
Mm.
Right. So I felt a little weird about this being there. It's you know very, it's very sexual, right? So she's not only naked. I mean, the monster is like that, right? So the succubus monster is a sexual creature that
right.
like. Kiss, like seduces you, kisses you, sucks your energy out that way.
Right.
And she's staring directly at the... She's hiding her face, but staring directly at the viewer.
Right.
Clearly knows that you're watching her.
Right.
So I now that I'm talking about it, I'm making myself more and more uncomfortable. the more that I dredge up my feelings about this. But I actually would not have this page open very often. It's in the index, so I guess that's part of it. But I would not have this page open very often, specifically to hide it from my parents. Why did you pick that out?
So we were talking about it. So this, I think we were looking at this shortly after the now very famous Amazon that we talked about
right.
Earlier in the show.
Right.
And actually you pointed out
yeah.
that, you know, she doesn't have a perfect body, that,
yeah.
you know, she's actually, you know, she's got little rolls on her belly.
Yeah.
And, you know, whereas the Amazon is this Barbie
right.
doll type of, you know, measurements.
Right.
So I kind of like that about this piece, you know, the fact that this is, you know, she's very womanly, you
right.
know, she's, you know, she's got some shape, some nice round shape
yeah.
to her, you know, which, you know, was kind of interesting. But, I mean, you know, I don't think it's like a particularly, you know, fantastic drawing. I think, you know, Darlene's, the two other pieces that we saw by
yeah.
her, I think were, you know, more successful. I think this looks less polished, I guess, but, you know, I just wanted to point out, like, how the body was treated.
I think when we flip through the whole book, I think that your reaction to her, like, complete composite, like, her full page stuff was a lot more energetic than
yeah.
than her here's one character stuff.
Right.
Her here's one character to fill in this space, you didn't feel that super...
Right.
You didn't feel as completely jazzed about her, like, full,
right.
full page composition.
Right, right, right. For sure, for sure.
Yeah, so that's... Yeah.
Anyway, so that's
anyway,
you know.
Thank you for making
yeah.
the 10-year-old me uncomfortable again for looking
no
at that.
No problem.
Okay, so now we're gonna. So those were about 3 or 4 pieces from the Dungeon Master's Guide. So now we're gonna go another year forward, 1980, and when the Deities and Demigods book was released, and so this was a compilation of kind of an expansion of a prior work on pantheons of gods that might exist or interact.
Mm-hmm.
In the D&D world from all kinds of different mythologies and literature. it has, we could do a whole episode on that, and it had copyright issues, and it had all kinds of things, and it was, you know, and this probably spawned a lot of what's called the Satanic Panic of religious figures finding this to be the zenith of offense.
Mm-hmm.
And so later, some number of years later on, they took out some parts, they renamed it Legends and Lords so that deities wasn't the title. And so a couple pieces. This is not a book that I had when I was a kid.
Right.
I knew about it. I borrowed it occasionally. I would hide it from my parents when I had it borrowed. So I didn't actually own this for a long time. And I myself am slightly more... The pieces are slightly fresher to me, I guess, in some ways. So the first thing that jumped out at you... And so here's a new artist, right? So here is an artist named Jim Rosloff that I don't think had pieces in D&D until now. And this is a picture of the Wild Hunt. So in the section on Celtic mythos. And I think the way the book is set up, like one artist did all the art for one particular pantheon, and there'll be like 12 or 20 pieces. So I think Jim Rosloff did everything in the Celtic mythos. And here is his picture of the Wild Hunt with the Wild Huntsman in the background and the hunting hounds in the front.
Mm-hmm.
So I will... This is not a piece that like was really fundamental to my D&D understanding. I looked at it. It's not a page rules wise that I needed to use a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So I probably haven't looked at this very much. Why did it jump out to you?
Well, so one of the things that I want to complain about, but you know, I feel like a lot of the pieces that we've seen so far, with a couple of exceptions, it seems that you are the viewer looking at a scene kind of like a little theater stage, and you're not really participating in it.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not really, you know, and, you know, again, with some exceptions, I'm not... Mm-hmm. No, you can keep that up, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. Whereas this one... not only are they coming right at you, like the hounds are coming right towards you.
Right.
This one in the back, the one in the back, is looking directly at you.
Yeah.
So that thing is actually running directly towards you.
Yeah.
And there's just such a sense of threat and danger of, like, you know, coming directly at you and coming fast that, you know, I think that's like a really, really successful piece. And I'm a sucker for like this very high contrast where you only have like two colors. You have white and you have black and that's it.
Yep.
And I love that. You know, it's like, it gives me this sense of like, you know, the a lot of like Iranian artists, you know, have like this very black and white illustration, like Satrapi, who did Persepolis.
Okay.
You know, and so you know, it's like this very, very strong contrast. And I love that in art. So... You know, I think I was a total sucker for that because of those two things, you know, like the high contrast and the action really coming right at you as opposed to you being in your seat and looking at it on a stage and it's going to go by and yeah, it's kind of scary, but you're not really involved in it.
You know, it's funny because I think when I've looked at this, I didn't feel they were coming right at me. I think that the sight line, you know, that kind of goes horizontally through the picture,
mm-hmm.
kind of gave me the impression that they were running at another figure off to my left.
Yeah.
But now that you mention that the huntsman is looking right at, like actually the weird thing, as you described that, I got like more and more uncomfortable. Like I got more and more like convinced, like, oh yeah, they are coming right at me, and I never noticed that before, and it actually made me very unsettled. When you pointed that out, and so now I look at this and I actually have an emotional reaction that I actually didn't have before.
Yeah, that's funny. Well, you know, we were attacked by wild dogs in upstate New York. You know,
you and your girlfriends.
That's right.
A couple weekends ago.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, I get. Okay, that makes sense.
Country dogs.
That makes sense.
Very scary for city people.
Now, and so this might be a whole. This should probably be a whole episode on its own.
Right.
So I don't even know where to begin. Oh my God. So there's a section on the Cthulhu mythos. So what I have here is the first edition. D&D Seven of Gods, it does have the Lovecraftian Cthulhu mythos, and that whole section, all the art was drawn by an artist named Errol Otis, who's infamous as like the most surreal D&D artist. He's still active today. He will run games, I think, like particularly at North Texas convention, I think he's prominent at. So he runs games, he draws, and so this crap, so here is, here. This is really ought to be Abhoth from, oh god, what's his name? Anyway, this ought to be Abhoth, they in the book they call this Shub-Niggurath, which I think is a little bit of a misstep by Rob Kuntz, actually. And so a horrible festering pool of uncleanliness far below the depths of mountain Vormithidreth, where it constantly spews forth alien creatures of chaos, and then either they escape free or they fall back and die and are consumed and eaten by their own mother of chaos. So this freaked the crap out of me, right? I cannot express that this particular illustration and the whole Cthulhu mythos by Errol Otis is the scariest single crap I have ever experienced in my entire life. And when I was 10 years old and I borrowed this, I was scared completely freaking witless. I'd never heard of Lovecraft. I'd never heard of Cthulhu. This is the first thing that I've been anti-horror my whole life.
Yes.
And this gave me friggin' nightmares. And this bothered me, this upset me so very much that I trained myself physically to know where in the book these pages were so that I could, on instinct, skip past the pages and never have to see this. So even to this day, I can put my thumbnail right in the start and right in the end of the Cthulhu section and skip past it entirely, because it's the single biggest nightmare I ever had in my life. And there you go. Okay, so there. So here I am looking. So here, fast forward, and here I am looking at it.
You're looking at it, and you're okay.
Sort of. for broad, a broad value of okay.
Yeah, right. But you know what's interesting about that is that, you know, I have a completely different take on that again, you know. So I look at it and, you know, so everything is like round and soft, you know, and I look at it and going, "Oh, this is art with maybe a little bit of a sense of humor to it." And then you look at it more and more closely and you go, "Oh, right, so it's an Irish comedy. So it's actually not funny at all, but it's terrifying and everybody dies at the end, right?" So it has like this really interesting layer because of that, because you're like, "Oh, what is that? That's like really, oh no, this is not cute at all. This is like, yeah, this is terrifying." And everywhere I look, things that I thought were like, you know, solid ground actually end up being this crawling, creepy creature that's coming in and out of the water or whatever the hell that is. So, you know, that's kind of, you know, so that's kind of like an interesting style of artwork that he has. And I think the second piece that we picked, you know, kind of has that same sense. So, you know, you just kind of go, "Oh, yeah, this is round and cutesy," and, "Oh, God, no, it's not.
Right, right. That mouth in the bottom right is just the scariest crap ever.
Yeah.
And the perspective's, you know, bad in a way. And, like, how is it black behind it? Like, how the hell is there, like, a giant abyss behind the mouth of the tongue thing that it's going to eat? Oh, my God, it's just so awful.
We can move on.
It's just so fucking awful.
We can move on to the next one.
Oh, my God, we should do that.
We should do that. And plus, we're way past our time.
Okay, so just one page, just flip the page, and now there's this horrible thing.
Right.
There's this equally awful thing. Right. And so I'm pretty sure this is on the page with the creature from Lovecraft's The Color Out of Space.
Mm.
And I can't... I'm sorry. Now I need the name of this horrible thing. Yog-Sothoth? Is that it? Yeah, I think it's Yog-Sothoth. I might be wrong. Interestingly, this is a pretty, I guess, pretty good depiction if you read Lovecraft's The Color Out of Space of that horrible monster at the end, but transposed from 20th century Massachusetts to a clear medieval fantasy world, and you have a proud castle with spires with fluttering pennants in the background and kind of fluffy clouds, and a beautiful princess that was picking up flowers a second ago, and this horrible fucking thing grabbing onto her, and it's just the juxtaposition is just brilliant and terrifying, and he's right. thrown this Lovecraftian horror smashing directly through your pleasant Arthurian fantasy world, and right. that is just really the worst thing ever.
Yeah, and there's something, you know, it's like it's grotesque in a you know really malevolent way, and yeah. you know, and there, you know, there's like a whole tradition of like artists doing, you know, really grotesque creatures that, you know, are like really incredibly disturbing. I'm like, right. what is going on in your brain when you're doing this, you know? So anyway, we can move on. We agree that this is very successfully terrifying for everybody.
So that whole section was yanked out, right? So later editions, like the second printing, yanked that whole section out.
Gotcha.
Largely for copyright issues, because the Chaosium company that had the right to print gaming materials for Cthulhu stuff got in touch and actually said, hey, you know, you should have asked us for permission.
Right.
You can keep using it as long as we can use the D&D trademark on some of our game materials. And I think they did that for a year or two, and then TSR said, nope, we want to be totally authoritarian about about copyright issues, and so we'll just punt you right out of the book and go to hell.
Interesting.
Go back to the hell from whence you came. So that got yanked out. Like the first edition that still contains that gets sold for a much higher price point. And anytime people are talking deities and demigods, or is this the one that has the Cthulhu mythos, or is it not? And it makes a big difference. But they yanked it out, and so it has. So on top of this horrible, horrible artwork, it also actually does have this like mystical. It now has the real world mystical Necronomicon-y. Like forbidden tome, right? Forbidden lost tome, right? That people are hunting for, and it's
right.
hard to find.
It's
and
hard
you might
to
not
find.
Find it, right? It has hidden, you know, mystical horrors.
But you know what happens to you
that,
if you,
that
if
are
you
the
find
actual
it.
Love, the actual Cthulhu horrors in this missing
right.
lost tome.
Now, if you find it, you go mad. Everybody knows that, so you know, don't look for
and
it.
And the fact that you referred to that whole thing as an Irish comedy just pushed like about 16 different triggers for me. So that was thank you for that. But Errol Otis, he does have this comic sensibility.
Right.
And then boy, if you pursue that thread, it's just like just 5 millimeters over, there's just outright raving horror.
Absolutely,
that comedy's leading to.
I mean, that's what I think. This was fascinating about his work, you know, because of that.
Okay, so a little bit later.
Yeah, we
so,
have a few more, so maybe move on.
So here we are in the Greek mythos with Zeus and Hera and so forth. And again, this is a piece by Jim Roslov. So Jim Roslov also got the Greek part with Titans and Cyclopes and things like that. So here is the famous scene of Hercules or Heracles fighting the lion, I believe for his first labor, the first of his 10 or 12 labors. And Heracles is basically unclothed, fighting a horrible lion. The way that you got the sort of the Parthenian-y type structure behind them. The way that this was cropped, the picture, because you were talking about how his Wild Hunt picture kind of jumps out of the frame at us.
Right.
And so the way this is cropped, the lion pokes up past the labels on the page. So I had to keep the Greek mythos page labels because the lion actually pokes up over them. I was slightly surprised that you picked this. Again, I don't spend a lot of time rules-wise on this page. I don't use the Greek mythos.
Mm-hmm.
So why did you pick this piece?
So I picked this piece because it really reminded me of the ancient Greek vases.
Yeah.
And the way the body is portrayed. And, you know, and the fact, you know, those vases were for the most part, monotones.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and so you had a lot of battle scenes and other stuff. This kind of reminded me of you know those ancient Greek vases. You know, and I could see that you know going around. An old amphora. You know, with the gods, the demigod. You know, fighting this lion. So, you know, I thought it was interesting because of that, you know, and again, you know, I really like his style and the high contrast that he uses. So that to me, you know, it was nice to see that he was looking beyond the, you know, Western medieval or Renaissance art that I feel a lot of stuff has influenced a lot of artists. So, you know, he was kind of like departing from the other style a little bit, you know, and referencing something else, referencing another way of depicting the body.
Now, I will point out that this is a little super heroic, as it should
be
for Heracles. And, you know, we're not, like, on our episode today, we're not looking at an artist named Bill Willingham, who did some D&D stuff and then had a long career in actual comics. But so this is a little super heroic, which I like, and it works. And so even though he's fighting the father of all lions, he clearly has the upper hand.
Mm-hmm.
It's the lion that looks desperate, and he's actually smiling a bit. Of like,
yeah.
He's confident enough.
He knows that, he's going to win.
He knows he's going to, that he's got the upper hand here, and he's actually smiling a little bit as though at the world's, you know, worst, you know, lion monster that he's about to defeat. So I like it. So other stuff in this book. So a couple pages later, this is the Indian. So that was Greek.
Yes.
Yeah. So this is the Indian mythos, and that EO up in the top corner, that's Aralotus. So the same guy that did the Lovecraft stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I have never used any of the Indian mythos. Again, I don't spend a lot of time on this page. But boy, that's breathtaking. I mean,
that is just absolutely
gorgeous.
It's really gorgeous. And again, you know, I picked this piece for the same reason that I picked the previous piece, because I feel like he actually uses a different language, different visual language than the other artists, and actually goes to, you know, the Indian style of rendering.
Yeah.
You know, in the Middle Ages. You know.
Yeah.
so you have like the way the arms are like. They're very stiff and angular,
yeah.
You know, the highly decorated body of the bull,
mm-hmm.
You know, just the way the things are rendered, you know, and it's different from the stuff that he was doing for Cthulhu.
Right.
So he clearly, you know, did his homework and
right.
was looking at how Indian artists of the Middle Ages were doing illustrations and really drew from, you know, that tradition. So I
right.
really appreciate that.
Right.
So that's why I picked that, and you know it's just absolutely beautiful.
I'm glad you were able to flip through that book, because it does say that these guys were conscientious, they're professional artists, they're doing research, and they can modify their style
absolutely
for the topic that
absolutely.
they want to express.
No, you can no the guy's got some chops. You know, it's just like this is just absolutely amazing, and you know I was actually surprised when we saw that it was him that
right.
I had done that, because
right.
it's very different from.
Right.
The other two pieces that we saw, so
the,
yeah.
The
that
building
was,
is gorgeous, and you know what?
Yeah,
I love
the
sea. I love that the sea there, that bay says like storm coming.
Yeah.
Right. It says it's windy. You've got froth on the waves. It's like there's yet another emergency brewing just off to the left,
mm-hmm.
and I can totally feel the wind blowing and the salty spray coming at me. And on top of everything else, I just love that busy sea that you have there.
Yeah, yeah. I think this is the last piece,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, so I think this is the last piece we're going to look at. And so the Norse mythos, in alphabetical order, comes pretty close to the end of the book. And here we are again with Jim Roslav. And so this is the mighty Thor, my favorite character of all time. In battle with the Midgard serpent, who is fated to either kill him or destroy the world. And coincidentally, you know, again, this is a piece that I just fell in love with when I was a kid. This is before I knew about Marvel Comics Thor character, right?
Interesting.
So this was also my first encounter with, there's someone named Thor, and boy, he's beefy, and he's got a big hammer, and fights the worst monsters ever. Interesting.
Right.
I'm intrigued. And coincidentally, just today, just the day that we are doing this episode, the Facebook AD&D group, someone posted this particular picture and said, let's talk about this picture, because boy, this is a real thunderbolt of a picture.
Oh, that picture is fantastic.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just like so many things about it that just work for me, you know. First of all, you know, again, you have this sense of danger, because the, you know, the serpent is obviously gonna run out of the page, you know, he's coming out of the page,
yeah.
you know, and he's a real threat. But the way he used all the Celtic knots that repeat the patterns of the serpent's body and the scale, and so you can't really tell where the serpent ends and begins, and is he part of all of this? Is he just like all around you, and it's just completely engulfing, you know, the figure in the middle?
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's just so powerful and such a good use of pattern that, yeah, so now I don't know who my favorite artist is anymore.
And just talking about this piece, even though the serpent is bigger, he's around him on all sides, he's above him, he's below him, his head is as big as his whole body, the way that the Thor figure is constructed has a solidity to it.
Mm-hmm.
The bulging muscles and the gloves are solid and the head is solid and the face is concrete and in the world. Is the Thor figure to me has actually more heft and more weight than the serpent figure, and it feels right to me that even though he's physically smaller, somehow he feels heavier. That this is at least a fair fight.
Interesting.
To me, is he just did the gloves and the arms and the muscles and the helmet and the horns just perfectly to convince me that there's just this immovable object confronting an irresistible force.
Interesting.
And on top of everything else, it's just delightful in every way, top to bottom.
This is just such a beautiful piece, and I'm glad we're ending on that one because it's just that he's become my favorite artist now.
Amazing. Okay, so we tried to limit ourselves to only have a double length episode here. So we saw Greg Bell in Zeroth Edition. We looked at, I think, three pieces each by Sutherland and Trampier and Darlene and Jim Rosloff coming in at the end with the Deities and Demigods. And you're saying that Errol Otis. Did I not say that?
You did not.
My God, he's stamped on my head so hard my mouth can't form him. So of those six total artists, your favorite right now would be what?
Yeah, right now, you know, I'm completely in love with Rosloff. Just talk to me next week, and you know, I'll find something else in like third edition, and I'll be like, oh, forget about him, you know. So fickle. You know what? There's love enough for all of them. I love all of them. All right? No, I really do. I mean, you know, except for that Amazon. You know, I think that, you know, we saw, you know, like really worthy artwork, and I think. It was really good for me to actually look more deeply into it.
Yeah.
You know, because I think I haven't really looked at the art that closely before. So it was actually very interesting and a really good discovery for me.
Yeah.
To see like the breadth of, you know, the skills and talent that, you know, those artists had in that first edition.
Cool.
So,
and I feel it's interesting because I feel like you've actually warmed up to it just like this week while we've been looking at like more pieces.
Totally.
And I think one of the more fascinating things is the radical difference.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we agree about some stuff in the world.
Some.
But the radical difference in perspective of my 40-year experience with this and your pretty much 40-hour experience with this.
Right.
And obviously you have an ocean of more art training, obviously. You're actually a professionally trained artist. I am just like, I think I like this.
I think that's
age 9.
That's legitimate. Yeah. That's a legitimate way of looking at anything. Yeah. You know, that there's no right or wrong.
Yeah.
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 So, you know.
Any other overview, final thoughts on the pieces that we saw today?
No, I think, you know, we want to know if you guys liked the, you know, what we talked about, and if you want to see more. We're also trying to think about indie artists that do indie illustrations.
So
if you have suggestions of people that we should look at, you know, send that to this guy.
So please leave comments on YouTube or Twitch our Facebook page or on Twitter. As Wandering DMs on every single one of those sites, you know, we're engaged in all that stuff nowadays, we got started with this and we thought we were going to be able to talk about, you know, D&D from 0th edition to 5th,
it was
just so overwhelming.
Yeah,
I mean, we couldn't even talk about the color covers today.
I know,
because that would have been a totally different oeuvre.
Oh, very nice.
So, leave some comments about what you want to see. So, things that we could possibly do in the future are, what about the color work? What about, you know, other editions, second or third? We didn't talk about BX, which was at the, in the same time period as today. We could talk fourth or fifth. Indie artists, you know, we could pull out one artist at a time and easily have a whole,
episode
just on just on Jim Rosloff or something like that, or where he came from or where he went or things like that. And we could. So tell us what you'd like to know. I'm just at a loss for all the interesting, deep things we could talk about.
I
don't know what we should do next. So Isabel, thank you so much. You totally need to go to multiple events today.
That's okay. I really enjoyed this. I was really looking forward to it, and I hope people liked it. I
think we're incredibly lucky to have you as a resource from time to time to input to that. What are your presences online if people want to go see more of your work?
So, you know, I'm at isabelgarbani.com, and there's only two of us in the world. There's one in Switzerland and one here, so I'm not the one in Switzerland, I'm the one here.
And just to be clear, Isabel is Isabelle.
Yeah.
There's no A at the end of that. Just
no
be
A.
Clear. And then Garbani.
Don't call me Isabella. And we'll go off to you.
And then Garbani, Garbani. And if you look at the Wandering DMs on Twitter or YouTube, I've got a link to her site.
Oh, great. Thank
so
you.
The other thing, so we'll be back. So Wandering DMs, we will be back in a week, Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time, like we always do. Paul will be back. Don't think that Paul has been taking this week off, because actually he's been very, very busy working on Wandering DMs, probably more busy than I've been, actually. So he's been hustling his butt off. And Paul will be back, and we should have at least one or two kind of exciting new announcements about Wandering DM stuff for next week.
Yeah, very good.
Huh?
Right?
So yeah, please do tune in, and I'm personally pretty excited about being able to reveal some stuff. So do please turn in. Remember that you can follow us on YouTube and Twitter and Twitch under the handle Wandering DMs. We are live every Sunday, 1 p.m. Eastern, so we'll be back next week for another thought-provoking discussion, and we'll talk to you next time.
Bye.